Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Very good evening to everyone. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at YourTalk. On behalf of YourTalk's team, of me, Sharif Khan, and Chintan Patel, I welcome all of you to the Myeloma Cure panel here today. We will be moderating the call and bringing people live on the show. CureTalk launched CurePanel last month as a series of monthly teleconference calls where we brought together disease experts, patients, bloggers, family members, and activists for a discussion on latest treatments under development. Today's show is co-hosted by Gary Peterson of MyelomaSurvival.com. Hi, Gary, and welcome to the show. Gary needs absolutely no introduction. He's a six-year survivor of multiple myeloma post-systemic
transplant.
He works with myeloma specialists to provide life expectancy and survival statistics through his site, MyelomaSurvival.com. His website's objective is to help move the survival rate from 4 years to 10 years. Our myeloma expert on the panel is Dr. Parameshwaran Hari from the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Hari, welcome to the CURE panel. Before I hand over to Gary Peterson, I would just briefly go through some of the important rules which would make the CURE panel experience really smooth. If you're listening in to the panel through your phone as well as a computer, please mute or stop the online broadcast on your computer for better audio quality. All panelists are requested to stay within the time limit allotted. Callers will be invited to ask questions at the end of the discussion. They can let us know by pressing 1 on their keypad. We will bring them online live. I think Dr. Hari has not called in yet. Dr. Hari, if you're on air, please press 1. If you call in, please press 1. We have not been able to identify your number. I don't think he's called in yet. Maybe just wait for a couple of seconds for him to join us. Gary, I think you can carry on with introducing the panelists. Gary, you'll go on air now.
Oh, okay. What I'd like to do is I'd like to introduce the panel, which we have 5 members, myself included, that are being treated by 5 different centers with 3 very different treatment philosophies. However, we all have one thing in common, and what that is that we all have a myeloma specialist on our team. And I think we're all pretty confident and believe that this is one of the most important elements in achieving a long-term life expectancy. Our first panel member happens to be Matt Goldman, and he's a myeloma patient with kidney involvement. He's a blogger and is being treated by an expert by the name of Dr. Berenson of the Institute for Myeloma and Bone Cancer Research, IMBCR. Then we have Pat Killingsworth, who is a 5-year myeloma survivor and has just gone through relapse. So this is very, very important to him. And he is undergoing treatment at Moffitt. He has 2 blogs, and I thought it was 2 books, but apparently while I was sleeping last night, he wrote another one. So he has 3 books on myeloma and is a dynamic advocate for the myeloma patient community. And not only that, is that next month in October, he will be co-hosting the next Myeloma Cure panel in October. Now, the next blogger is Laura Puente, and she is also a caregiver, and that's a difficult thing to do because I know that now. My wife had breast cancer, and I became the caregiver from being the caretaker. And she's the caregiver to her husband, David, who is a 4-year survivor and is being treated currently at the University of Arkansas Medical Center in Little Rock, Arkansas, one of 2 locations where I received treatment as well. Next is Keith Virgin. However, I think this is false advertising because Keith is not a virgin. Sorry, Keith, I couldn't help myself. But that is when it comes to the disease, because he has MGUS, and that's a precursor to myeloma. However, his disease has been moving towards smoldering, and his fear of progression is very well founded, and that's because it's very unfortunate, but not only he, but his father and his brother have had multiple myeloma, and his father and his brother have since passed. So Keith is very concerned, and understandably so. Keith is in a clinical trial at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. Priya, is Dr. Hari online?
Yes, I am online, Gary. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Well, Dr. Hari, I can only tell you how honored I am that you have given us the time to, cover this topic, and also for Priya for giving us this forum from Cure Talk for giving us this forum for doing this. Now, Dr. Hari has many achievements, the first of which he happens to be the clinical director of adult bone marrow transplant program and the associate professor of medicine in the division of hematology and oncology for the Medical College of Wisconsin. Now that's quite a mouthful, but it's not all that he's done. His myeloma program has the best 2- and 3-year myeloma survival rate yet presented on the Myeloma Survivor website, which means you are 7 times more likely to survive 3 years in his care than in the care of the average facility that reports their data to the National Cancer Institute. He was voted to the National Best Doctors in 2011 and 2012. He is also the scientific director of the CIBMTR, which is the Center for International Blood and Marrow Transplant Research. And this organization represents over 500 transplant centers across the globe. I do, however, only have one issue with Dr. Hari, and that is that I struggle to pronounce his first name. Dr. Parameshwaran Hari?
That's very good. Thank you.
Is that close, Dr. Hari?
That is. Thanks.
Okay. Okay, our last doctor, by the way, for the Cure panel, needed only 7 letters for his entire name. And I got to say, the next doctor is going to be an Ed or a Jim, for my sake. But in any event, what I'd like to do now is to start this presentation with you, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go ahead, Gary. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Okay, and start with what I'd like to do is, we will be talking about disease progression in multiple myeloma, and that's one thing that I think that all of the patients will one day be confronted with. And what I mean by that is that the disease will go through stages, first relapse, then it becomes refractory, and finally we go into a higher risk disease, I believe. And as a result, I was wondering if you might be able to give us a little background on these stages of the disease and what types of treatment that you would recommend for this disease.
Thank you, Gary, and thank you, Priya. I'm also honored to be on this panel and help answer any questions that you may have. So Gary's question really pertains to relapse. Now, to call a situation relapse, by two scientific terms, the person the patient must have achieved a remission, complete remission, prior to the relapse. So if somebody gets to what we call a complete remission, which essentially means that we did all the tests that we currently have for myeloma and we could not find any disease, we call them a complete remission. And at that, from that point on, if there is any recurrence of the disease, then you call it relapse. In myeloma, that term may not be the most accurate term. The better term is progression, meaning your disease is beaten down, but we know that in patients with myeloma, what determines a complete remission really is our ability to detect disease. Even when we say someone is in a complete remission, there may be small microscopic amounts of disease, and that eventually leads to disease coming back or disease progressing from that point on. So some people only achieve a partial remission to their initial treatment. Some people achieve what we currently call a complete remission, whereby our current techniques cannot detect any disease in them. And in some cases, we call patients to be in a stringent complete remission, which means that even with some extra sensitive techniques, we cannot detect disease. But eventually, the vast majority of patients do progress or relapse, which means the disease starts growing again and there is need for further treatment. Now, to take issue with one thing that Gary said it happens to all. It need not necessarily happen to all. There is probably 10 to 15% of people who have been treated in the last decade who may not ever progress, meaning at 15 years, they are still in their first remission, whether it's a complete remission or whether it's a near complete remission, you know, in some sort of remission which does not get worse or does not progress beyond that. So that number, if we increase that number all the way up to 100%, obviously we've cured everybody. And increasing that number is the first step that we really need to do. Because again, as Gary suggested, the best shot at treating myeloma is in the first go round, because disease tends to be more sensitive to treatment initially, and when people relapse or progress, the disease becomes a little bit more complicated, more advanced, more resistant to drugs. So there's two things that we're dealing with here. One is how to prevent people from progressing or relapsing after their initial response, and number two, how to treat patients so that the treatment at relapse is also very good. So there are, those are the twin issues really which will make long-term survival, you know, in measured in many decades possible for the majority of patients. Now, but that eventually, in my this is my feeling, it will translate into a cure. You know, if we have a large number of patients not relapsing after their first remission, and even when in those people who do relapse, if we have effective treatments that can put them back into their original state. Those are the twin targets to get to a long-term cure of myeloma. So let's address the first thing. So the first thing is how to get to a deep remission that stays on for a long time. Now, when I talk to patients, one of the things that comes up is this question about, you know, should I get to a complete remission? Obviously, you know, if we're having no disease is better than having some disease intuitively. But I would argue that time is what we have, really, you know, as human beings and as patients and as myeloma patients or whatever we look at it, time is really the one thing that the most valuable commodity. So if you are in a complete remission and it's only a short-lived one, it doesn't really mean much compared to another person who achieves only a partial remission, but that is a long-lived one. So disease control for a long time is the first goal of treatment. Disease control means non-progressive disease. So disease should not progress, and it should stay like that for a long, long time. So currently we have very aggressive strategies that we employ in some people, like multi-drug chemotherapy to achieve an induction response. You know, so first drugs that we use, some of the myeloma experts believe in using a combination of drugs that gets a quick, deep response. And then collection of stem cells, and many experts believe in doing an upfront transplant, which means you do the transplant as part of the initial plan, irrespective of the response you got with the first round of treatment. And then subsequent to that, what we call consolidation or maintenance treatment, wherein you do additional treatment in the form of chemotherapy to to prevent the disease from coming back. So this is the most aggressive strategy that we employ right now. Recently, a study was published by the CALGB group from in the U.S., wherein patients who got initial treatment and an upfront transplant with their own stem cells, so an upfront autotransplant, followed by the use of this drug lenalidomide or Revlimid for on a low dose and on an ongoing basis as maintenance. In that study, approximately 50% of patients remained without progression of disease at 4 years. Now that's, you know, in a study setting, that's one of the best results we have. Now the other argument that some myeloma experts also make is that you could also defer the transplant, collect the stem cells and hold them in the freezer and continue with chemotherapy for a longer period, and then when the disease progresses from there, use the stem cells at that time. Now that I personally don't subscribe too much to that philosophy unless there is an overriding reason not to do the transplant, mainly because I think the first remission, I'm one of these people who believe that the first remission is the best remission, and in many diseases such as myeloma, where in many hematological cancers like myeloma, we find that the first remission really is always the longest. The second remission tends to be a little shorter unless we find a new drug, which is a blockbuster drug. So we have patients from when Revlimid was a new drug where their first treatment was not so good. We didn't have such good treatments, say, 12 years ago. They progressed and they got Revlimid on a study, and then they're still going in their second remission, keeping ongoing without a problem. So unless we get new blockbuster drugs, if we have the same armamentarium that we have right now, we would not get we would expect the first remission really to be the best remission. So that's why I believe in a more aggressive approach. And right now, the most commonest aggressive approach is to do a three-drug induction treatment. So when someone gets diagnosed with myeloma, they get a combination of three drugs. Usually in the United States, approximately 60% of patients are treated with those three drug combinations, which is bortezomib or Velcade, with Revlimid or lenalidomide, and dexamethasone as steroid. So that is one combination. The second three-drug combination is a combination of bortezomib or Velcade with cyclophosphamide or Cytoxan, which can either be given as a pill or an IV, along with dexamethasone. So the first one is called RVD by some experts, or VRD, Velcade, Revlimid, dexamethasone, or Revlimid, Velcade, dexamethasone. And the second combination is CVD or cyclophosphamide, Velcade, dexamethasone. Or some people call it Cyborg, because Velcade is also known as bortezomib, C-Y-B-O-R-D. These two combinations approximately are about 60% of all the new patients that get a transplant, and then after 4 to 5 cycles of this, after a response has been induced, the patient collects their stem cells and proceeds to a transplant. And then right now we have a national large study going on where different forms of consolidation treatment or maintenance are compared. Now that's the first strategy to prevent progression early on. So we try to get the first treatment to last a long, long time. So if we say in the last decade, 10 to 15% of patients are 15 years out without any progression, we're hoping that in this decade we can even double or triple that number to about 40% of patients being progression-free at 10 years, for example. Now that would be a significant achievement. We don't know that yet, but that's what we're hoping for. Now, how do we know? So it's not feasible often to wait 10 to 15 years to find out if it didn't work. 10 years go by and we find that we are no better than we were last decade. So we have some surrogate things which tell us that this might be actually happening. Now, the commonest surrogate technique is what we call defining deep responses. Now, as I told you before, when we call a remission, when we say someone is in a remission, we just says we looked and we didn't find it. So the second question becomes, how hard did you look? So typically we do look at things like M-protein, which is a electrophoresis test that has been around since 1939, so you can understand how long that's been going on. Then there is this test called serum-free light chain. Then there is, of course, the time-tested bone marrow biopsy, where you get a bone marrow biopsy and look at it under the microscope to count the plasma cells. So this is the classic complete remission definition. About 5 years ago, we defined a little more stringent definition, which is called a stringent complete response. Now, the feeling or the early evidence is that if you look harder and you don't find any myeloma cells, that means that the patient is in a better state, and that state is going to last longer than a person who has detectable disease. And nowadays, we have what we call four-color, multicolor flow cytometry, which is a technique of counting hundreds of thousands of cells quickly from the bone marrow and to see how many of these are bad plasma cells. Now, there are also good plasma cells. You know, all of us have plasma cells which have an immune function in the body. So if a person's bad plasma cells in a sample of hundreds of thousands of cells is minimal, then you are in a good, better state. So if flow cytometrically defined remissions tend to last longer, that we know. So what we are doing now is in these aggressive strategies, we go back and look at people's bone marrows and light chain studies, and even there are molecular techniques of figuring out how low you've gotten the myeloma down to. If we can, if with these newer modern techniques, if we don't find any myeloma cells in a person or no evidence of myeloma cells, which means the biochemical tests are normal, the bone marrow tests are normal, even with the advanced techniques, that means we have less than one in a million myeloma cells. If you get to that kind of a level, we believe that is going to translate into a longer remission. And that's really the goal of the people who pursue this aggressive strategy up front. Now, there is another group of people who believe that you don't really need to get so hard because there is always the toxicity of treatment. If you increase the treatment intensity, you also cause toxicity. You cause side effects. And sometimes these side effects can be very severe and sometimes even fatal. So there is a counter argument, those doctors believe that even if you have a small amount of myeloma cells in your body, you can live with that for a long time as long as you do. And that is true. You know, there is, as Gary said in the definition in the initial introduction, there are people with MGUS or monoclonal gammopathy of unknown significance who are living with a myeloma clone. There is a little bit of a early myeloma cell population in their bodies, but many of them, most of them actually, don't even get to myeloma. So the counter argument has some merit to it, but in my view, it does not apply to the vast majority of people. It applies to a minority of people where you can actually get the disease down, and it is kind of, so it all again boils down to how aggressive is your initial disease. If you have an aggressive disease, it is unlikely that you can live with a little bit of that aggressive disease for a long time. You really have to get that disease down quickly and deeply and with as minimal trace of that disease as possible. Whereas if you have less aggressive disease, you could go back into a state similar to MGUS or smoldering myeloma and stay with a small amount of paraprotein and small amount of myeloma cells in your body without them progressing. So number one thing, the most important thing in a person who gets treated for myeloma upfront is control of disease, a long-term disease control using either a very aggressive strategy or a less aggressive strategy wherein you preserve, you prevent side effects, but you've got enough disease down and the disease clone itself is not highly malignant or highly aggressive, and the person can live with that for a long period. So that's number one. Now, the second part of your question, Gary, was treatment of relapse. Now, relapse is, as again you suggested, it is near universal, but not by no means universal. And after the treatment of relapse depends on two or three things. Most important thing is how aggressive is the relapse. So if a relapse happens to a person we have treated aggressively and it happens, say, within the first year, that's unfortunate, but does happen. That means it is probably a very aggressive clone that has come back because it survived all this intense treatment, multiple drugs, essentially combining most of the useful drugs in myeloma in the upfront setting, and then it comes back too quickly. So an early relapse, say after a transplant, is bad. Secondly, a rapid relapse, meaning if someone's paraprotein, say, is 0.5 today, and 2 months later it's 2.5, it means that the myeloma cells are producing a lot of paraprotein in a very short time, and the amount of myeloma in the person's body is exploding, in fact. That's bad. Thirdly, some patients relapse with disease in the sites outside their bone marrow. We call that extramedullary relapse, which means sites outside the bone marrow are involved in the myeloma. This can happen in the form of fluid collections around your lung. It can happen in the liver, and rarely it can even involve this fluid around the brain or the cerebrospinal fluid. All of these situations are bad, and that again predicts for highly aggressive disease. So that's aspects of the disease that affect how relapse is treated. Secondly, it's aspects of the patient. This is how strong are you? So it is always easier to pick up and treat disease in a person who is stronger. That's why we have the surveillance program. Most patients with myeloma who have undergone treatment come back and have their labs checked for myeloma protein using free light chains or electrophoresis. Some people check it every 6 weeks, some people check it every 8 weeks. The longest I've seen is people checking it about 12 weeks. So somewhere between the 6 and 12 week range, people are getting their labs checked. And that needs to happen because even before the patient becomes symptomatic or has symptoms of disease coming back, we need to detect it so that we can intervene quickly, especially in cases of early relapse and aggressive relapse. Finally, the important thing in how we treat disease is what did you treat the person with upfront? So if a person has been on Revlimid, for example, as a drug initially, and they continue on Revlimid all the time, and say 3 years later the disease is progressing, they never got a transplant, their disease is progressing now while they're on Revlimid. So at that time, we would argue that the Revlimid is unlikely to be helpful, and we would choose a strategy of a non-Revlimid-containing regimen to treat that person's relapse. And then, since this person especially did not have a transplant, think about doing something like a transplant. On the other hand, if a person got a transplant and they had an early relapse, in the setting of transplant, we define an early relapse as something that happens within two years of the transplant. If that happens, it is less likely that a second transplant at that time is going to be much helpful. If there are studies for patients with that kind of early relapse where we do use a second transplant, but then it has to be in some way different from the first time you did it, either in terms of the specific drugs used, or maybe it would be a donor transplant instead of a patient's own cells, or it might be in the form of maintenance after the second transplant. But again, the point is that how we treated the person in the first round matters a great deal in picking drugs for the second rounds when it does come back again. Another important thing is the type of side effects that the person got. Say someone had severe neuropathy on bortezomib or Velcade. So this is one of the major side effects of Velcade, is the development of neuropathy, which is a nerve damage in the form of tingling, numbness, pain, and difficulty walking or using fine movements of the hands. And that tends to happen to a percentage of people that use bortezomib. The numbers of people getting it have gone down in the recent couple of years because of changes we made to how we use the drug, but still it can be a problem. In such a person, you'd be very careful about using that drug again. Now, we have alternatives like carfilzomib or and some of the other clinical trial drugs which don't seem to have neuropathy as a side effect, although they are in the same class as Velcade. So there are alternatives there. But again, the point I'm trying to make is that the side effect profile from the first round of treatment is an important variable to consider when we treat relapse. Now let's see how aggressive you need to be with relapse. So for a long time, this was again a matter of controversy and debate. Say someone has relapsed with their myeloma. We look at what agents they have been exposed to in the past, and we make a prediction of how each agent is likely to work. Suppose someone had a transplant 5 years ago, they were not on maintenance, and now the disease is coming back, and the only drug they got 5 years ago before transplant was, say, Revlimid and dexamethasone. Now, you would expect in that person pretty much any drug that we have right now to work. So Revlimid would work because they only had it for about 4 or 5 months before transplant. Transplant would work because they had 5 years of remission from their first transplant. Bortezomib or Velcade would work because they have not even seen the drug. Conventional chemotherapy drugs such as Cytoxan or Doxorubicin would work because they have not seen that drug. Dexamethasone alone would work because they only seen 4 or 5 months of dexamethasone in the upfront setting. So essentially, such a person has a wide choice of drugs they could go back to. How do we use these drugs? So one group of doctors used to argue that you should use drugs sequentially. So in this person, you would use Revlimid now and then keep going on Revlimid till the disease progresses on Revlimid, and at that time use Velcade. So that's the argument for the people who believe in sequential use of drugs. So you get maximum mileage out of each drug for the maximum period, and then you go on to the next drug. And then if a couple of drugs have failed, then you try combinations. So that's one approach. The other approach would be to use a newer three-drug combination, such as bortezomib, Revlimid, dexamethasone, which is considered an aggressive regimen, as I alluded to earlier, for induction. You use that to get a quick response and then do something in the form of maintenance or a second transplant or something. For the longest time, we didn't really have much evidence that one approach was better than the other. Very recently, a paper was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology where investigators compared the use of thalidomide and dexamethasone with the combination of Velcade, thalidomide, and dexamethasone. So two drugs versus three drugs in the setting of relapse of myeloma, and that study showed that persons who got a better three-drug combination tended to have a better, a longer time from progression of disease. So you get more mileage if you use a more potent synergistic combination of drugs. So increasingly, I am also convinced of that use, and if in the scenario that I just described, where a person is essentially sensitive to all drugs that you have, I would treat them. If they were in good shape physically, I would give them a four-drug combination and then even explore the possibility that they want to undergo a second transplant and at that time use maintenance. So we expect a second transplant to give people at least 50% or sometimes a little more than 50% of the time they got from the first one. So if this person, I go with Velcade, Revlimid, Dex combination for 4 months and then do a second transplant and then put them on, say, Revlimid maintenance, I would expect another 3 years or in that line. Before their disease came back a third time. So this is one of the aggressive approaches at relapse. The less aggressive approach, as I told you earlier on, would be to use a single drug such as Revlimid and dexamethasone, get a response, and keep going on that drug for as long as it is effective. So continued maintenance of that drug.
Okay. So the way I see it, your best shot and your most is to take care of it. You know, the first shot is the best shot, and then what we've just heard from you is what you do with relapse, and then you even talked about refractory, meaning that the disease does not respond to a certain drug like Revlimid, and you'd go on from there. You mind, doctor, if we go on from here with some of the questions from the other
not at all.
Panelists?
No. Yeah, please go on.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Matt, I know that you've got to leave here relatively quickly, so would you ask Dr. Hari your question?
Sure. First of all, doctor, thanks for your time. And I wanted to ask about patients that have either kidney involvement or bone involvement. If when and if they relapse, does the disease manifest itself in the same way? Will you still just see kidney involvement, or will you still just see bone involvement?
So that's a very good question, Matt. So the answer is that if you have a good doctor, you should not see either of those involvements. So we call kidney involvement and bone involvement are what we call target organ damage in myeloma. So the first time a person gets myeloma, obviously they were in good health. They never even heard of this disease. Suddenly one day they have bone pain or a back fracture or something like that, and they get diagnosed with myeloma. And same thing with the kidney. They go in feeling tired. They get or anemic or not making urine, and suddenly that creatinine is high. Further workup leads to myeloma. Now, once a person gets back in remission, the subsequent involvement with or relapse of myeloma, it tends to, if we don't follow the person and we just let things happen, then you would expect the same thing to happen. So kidney involvement typically in myeloma is with the accumulation of light chains in the kidney and blockage of the tubules. That's what we call myeloma cast nephropathy. There's also other mechanisms such as light chain deposition disease, glomerulonephritis, urinary infections, many, many ways in which that myeloma-related kidney damage can happen. But it all boils down to the fact that myeloma protein tends to go get excreted through the kidney, and it can block up the kidneys. And the idea of being on surveillance, as I told you before, some people get surveilled or people get labs done for the myeloma protein. Between 6 to 12 weeks each time, every 6 or 8 weeks, they're going to the doctor and having their labs checked. Typically, for people with kidney involvement, it is light chains that are elevated, and if the light chains keep going up, we know that kidney damage is imminent, and you need to intervene before that. So you would depend on your physicians to pick it up and intervene before kidney damage sets in. So the second time around, it is highly unlikely, if you're followed in any reasonable oncology practice, that you would end up with kidney damage again. That really should not happen. Same thing with bone involvement. If someone's protein levels are going up and you know that they had bone involvement in the first round, you would immediately try to intervene. Or in the case of bone, we have a test. We have tests such as the MRI or the PET scan in many instances where early bone involvement can be picked up quickly and intervened. So the myeloma protein happens to be a marker that gives us a idea that something's about to change, and then you need to intervene before tissue damage. In the relapse setting, intervention before tissue damage is possible, and it should happen. That, you know, under the care of your doctor, that really should be happening.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Matt. Pat, your question?
Sure. Yeah, great. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you. I can hear you, Pat.
Okay. Well, I understand clinical trials, I think, are a wonderful thing, and sure wish more patients would sign on. And in most cases, I know there's very little risk to the patient. For example, if it was a Kyprolis study, and the control group is using Revlimid and dexamethasone, and the test group is using Kyprolis, Revlimid, and dexamethasone or something, you know, there's certainly very little risk. But I'm concerned about these push now to be for clinical trials for MGUS or smoldering myeloma, because, you know, now you're exposing the myeloma to drugs earlier, and to me it's like you're starting the meter in a taxi cab or something. Once you're exposed to the drug, it's sort of like the meter starts. At least that's my impression. So I'm leading the witness, I know, but I just wondered, you know, how you feel about studies for treating smoldering myeloma aggressively early in an attempt to slow down the progression to symptomatic myeloma, I guess. Do you have an opinion on this?
Absolutely. That's a very informed question, really, Pat, and it's a tough question to answer. So I was completely on your side of the equation on this question until about 2 years ago. So let's put this thing in perspective for people who may not be as informed as you are. So MGUS, or monoclonal gammopathy of unknown significance, and smoldering myeloma are what we call pre-myeloma conditions. The vast majority of people with MGUS actually do not go on to get myeloma. So only about 20% of people convert to myeloma in their lifetime. So if you get diagnosed with MGUS, the odds are 80% chances that you will not even get myeloma in your lifetime. Smoldering myeloma, on the other hand, is a little bit more risky, in that 80% of people with smoldering myeloma eventually go on to myeloma, but 20% do not go to myeloma. So it's kind of the inverse here. Now, in any clinical trial or in any intervention in medicine, we really have to think of risk versus benefit. In a person with MGUS, we have some risk stratifying tools which we use to assign a risk of higher risk of some people going to myeloma versus a lower risk in some other people. Even with these risk stratifying tools for MGUS, if the patient has been correctly diagnosed with MGUS, the maximum risk of transforming to myeloma is not more than 5 or 7% per year. So if you have 100 people with high-risk MGUS, only 5 or 7 of those people go on to myeloma. With regards to your question, to take an ongoing medicine, which is, if it's a true medicine with side effects and all that kind of stuff, and get started on treatment for a situation where the overwhelming majority of people don't actually get into trouble, you are, you know, your risk-benefit ratio, I would argue, is not in the not in favor of benefit. It's more in favor of risk, because you're taking an active medicine with side effects, and that can cause trouble. Whereas there are some trials in MGUS setting itself with things like curcumin or things which are really not, diet modification, acupuncture, things which have low risk of side effects. And I would argue that those kind of things where the risks of side effects are low, it is reasonable to try them out. So if it's an active medicine such as chemotherapy or Revlimid or, medications which have a side effect profile that puts them in the strictly medication category, if you change your diet and see what happens in MGUS, it would not be such a big deal, because the risk of changing diet is not so much, and if there is a benefit, you would see it in some people who have high risk of progression to myeloma. In smoldering myeloma, the situation is a little bit more nuanced. Within smoldering myeloma, as I told you, majority of people go on to have myeloma, and actually 50% of people go on to have myeloma within the first 5 years. So we have, again, risk stratifying tools to identify who are these people who have a very high risk of progression to myeloma. In those people, we call high-risk smoldering myeloma. It may be things like the amount of the plasma cells in the bone marrow, if it's a high number of plasma cells in the bone marrow. It may be the proportion of good plasma cells to bad plasma cells in the bone marrow, that using a technique called flow cytometry. Actually, the Spanish group actually uses this as their primary criteria. It may be the ratio of light chains in your blood. If there's a very high light chain ratio involving one of the light chains against the other one, that may be a high-risk marker. So patients with high-risk smoldering myeloma have a much higher proportion of transforming to myeloma, even more than the 80% who go on to myeloma during the course of the next decade. So if you have a study for high-risk myeloma, you could argue that you could have an intervention which makes a difference, because the reason to have that argument is that, similar to this relapse situation where the myeloma becomes more difficult to treat at relapse, the argument is that maybe smoldering myeloma is a pre-myeloma state. It might be easier to treat in the pre-myeloma state. So that's why there have been these trials. And I'm always torn whether to recommend that a person go on this trial or not. Seeing myeloma day in and day out, you get a feel for this. And when all the criteria point to a high-risk smoldering myeloma patient, I nowadays recommend a clinical trial to prevent progression to myeloma. In fact, there was a trial presented about 9 months ago at ASH from the Spanish group, where they put patients with high risk. They selected patients with smoldering myeloma of a high risk. So only the high risk smoldering myeloma, not all comers, received lenalidomide or Revlimid, and the other group did not receive lenalidomide. And they were able to show that the people who did receive lenalidomide had benefit in terms of survival. So there was at least one trial which was very nicely done, which shows that. That trial has not yet been published, to my knowledge. And till it's published, it won't be, it won't enter the full evidence base of medicine. But there are some signals that high-risk smoldering myeloma population may be a population to target with an earlier intervention. Now, you could also argue the other case. If you're targeting those patients with a low-risk treatment, but if you're 100% certain they're going to go on to myeloma, then why not give them whole hog, treat them like myeloma? Now, that may happen, now you have argued both ways. You're introducing more risky treatment. So it is a very nuanced discussion. But I firmly believe that if the risk of, the first question a person with smoldering myeloma has to, or a MGUS situation has to ask their doctors, what is my true risk of progression to active myeloma? If that risk of progression is in single digits, as it is for MGUS, it makes no sense to take a potentially harmful drug, a potentially harmful intervention, such as any drug that we use to treat active myeloma. Whereas if that risk is high, such as in high-risk smoldering myeloma, where the risk of transforming to myeloma in the next 5 years could be up to 90% for the people with high-risk smoldering myeloma, in that situation, it may be reasonable to use a drug and get on treatment sooner, because high-risk smoldering myeloma may be easier to treat than active myeloma. There is this concept of additional mutations and additional genetic abnormalities that the cells pick up over time, and some of the second hits has not happened in many of these patients. In that case, earlier intervention might be more effective. Did that address your question, Pat?
I understand the risk, No, I just think then let's say it's lenalidomide. You've now used lenalidomide for 3 or 4 years, and the myeloma becomes active. It's unlikely that drug would be very effective, isn't it?
That is true. So for sure that. So, but the argument is that if you have high-risk smoldering myeloma, you're not going to stay 3 or 4 years in that situation without needing some treatment. So the high-risk smolderers, you know, we definitely would not use lenalidomide for an MGUS and then risk it. But if you have high-risk smoldering myeloma, the argument is that you're imminent myeloma. Your myeloma is about to happen very soon. And
so it's sort of like what, you know, what I said in, I think, my first ASH 3 years ago, where RVD was just starting to be used, and physician stood up and asked the questions of the panel, well, wait a minute, why aren't you exposing the patient to, you know, a second drug? And, you know, so it sounds like a similar argument.
Right, exactly. So so that's exactly the point. So we now know that a better induction gives you a better response. And again, you know, Revlimid maintenance is the same thing after transplant. You're exposing patients to lenalidomide maintenance, at a lower dose, all the same, but still many years of maintenance, and then whatever comes back after that may be resistant. And the use of Revlimid after that is pretty much either going to be at short term or not effective at all. Shorter than it would be.
Okay, we're going to have to go on from here, if you don't mind.
Sorry, Gary.
Okay, I'm sorry, Pat. We're running a little bit behind. But what we're going to have to do is, Lori and Keith, we're going to have to cancel one of you two. Anybody? Do I have any?
I could go
anybody
fast.
Who will give up their time slot?
Go ahead, Keith.
Thank you, Lori. I appreciate that. Keith, do you want to ask your question?
Dr. Hari?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yeah.
Dr. Barlogi's got me on the MGUS smoldering protocol down at Little Rock, SW120. And I myself, I'm taking curcumin, and the doctor's got me on the Yes.
This is Gary. You've got a feedback. Do you have your computer and your phone on?
No, I'm far away from it.
Okay. All right.
Let me walk a little further away.
Go on.
Dr. Bart's got me on Someta infusion every 3 months, and I'm getting tested about every 2 months. My question is, with the smoldering / MGUS, you know, with the I'm wondering about the, you know, the you know, you've probably answered my question of the kappa lambda ratio. If that is out of sync, if that's a little bit high, going up, and your quantitative protein's a little high, is it? And of course, you've heard about my background. Is that a more likelihood that you'll eventually develop myeloma, or am I just crossing a bridge before I get there?
Then the chances of going to myeloma are definitely higher than a person who has MGUS. However, there is a subpopulation of people with smoldering myeloma who never get to myeloma. And the kappa lambda ratio being a little off doesn't make much of a difference. For the kappa lambda ratio to be significantly considered a problem for smoldering myeloma, it has one of the light chains. Either kappa should be 8 times or higher than the lambda, or the lambda should be 8 times or higher than the kappa. So if it's, you know, I think I read your question on the email, and I think you said it was a kappa elevation of 2.5. And that's actually, you know, if it's a kappa smoldering myeloma, unless it's 8 or more, it really doesn't hit the threshold of being considered serious or high-risk smoldering myeloma. So the a significant elevation in the number of plasma cells in the bone marrow, a significant elevation in the number of the kappa lambda ratio, 8 times or more for one versus the other. And there is a flow cytometric test where they look at the number of residual normal plasma cells in the bone marrow. So if that number is less than 5%, that again is a higher risk for transforming to high-risk smoldering myeloma. So it wouldn't, based on your kappa lambda number, it's not all doom and gloom. And it is a matter of, you know, many things before it changes shape. If you've gone on for many years for smoldering myeloma, especially if you've gone on for beyond first five years from diagnosis with smoldering myeloma without getting to active myeloma, the risk of transformation actually goes down. So the highest risk of transforming from smoldering myeloma to myeloma is within the first 5 years after diagnosis. After that, patients who have gone the first 5 years without transforming to myeloma tend to transform more like an MGUS. A smaller number transform to myeloma each year.
Oh, great, doctor. My follow-up to that, my M protein was 1.8 in the bone marrow, 1.8 grams per deciliter, and the percentage of the plasma cells, the M plasma cells, was 12.5% in my bone marrow aspirate, and in the actual core sample.
Right.
Does that?
And how many years have you had smoldering myeloma for?
I've had it. It'll be a year in December.
So based on the numbers you've given me, you do not fit the criteria for high-risk smoldering myeloma, because I saw that your kappa-lambda ratio was 2.5 or something, and 12% plasma cells, M-protein of 1.8. You don't really fit the criteria for high-risk smoldering myeloma. Your risk may be very low, actually.
Well, great. That's wonderful. I'll pass the witness. I'm a trial lawyer, so I'll pass it to Lori there, if Lori has a question.
Sorry, my question was, am I muted?
No, I can hear you, thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry. My question was, you know, everything in myeloma is fluid, and when I hear people talking with their local oncologist as opposed to going to, say, a research facility or even a specialist, there's a lot of talk about, you know, high risk, low risk, and then, of course, in Arkansas, the ultra high risk. And the criteria being used for low and high risk out in the local communities seems to still be far behind what the researchers are classifying now as low and high risk. What, as you understand it right now, what is the current criteria that you're using, or what are these changes that you, as you understand them, for determining a low risk or high risk patient?
So for me, the high risk, low risk situation depends on our, you know, randomized trials that we have done in Europe and the U.S. Most of the factors are the well-established ones. So cytogenetics, FISH-based studies, and we use a plasma cell-enriched FISH, like most people do now, so that you find these abnormalities even in higher proportions of patients. And beta 2 microglobulin and intransferase stage. So the large German multi-center study, which was published in several papers over the last year, have shown that a combination of the international staging system and FISH-defined abnormalities for abnormalities such as 414 translocation or 1420 translocation or chromosome 1 amplification or the 17p mutation are in combination with the international stage are really the most powerful predictors in patients undergoing. So this is for patients undergoing aggressive strategies of induction followed by transplant followed by potential maintenance. So that's what we use in our standard for our standard population. In studies, we use other markers such as gene sequencing tests, including the Arkansas model for gene expression profiling. And there are other approaches that are being developed as we speak. So these are not well validated, so it would be unfair to ask the community doctors to use them. So I think a person with myeloma really has the right to expect that their community doctor stages them accurately at diagnosis and also orders plasma cell-enriched FISH from their bone marrow. In fact, if the difficulty in the community is that the first doctor that sees the patient and does their bone marrow does not know that they have myeloma. When you go to a myeloma center, that doctor already knows that you have myeloma, and that bone marrow there will actually be tested for more things than the first bone marrow. First bone marrow may be done for just anemia, or why is this person anemic, why is this person with a low white cell count. So that bone marrow is sometimes not sent for all the myeloma testing, and sometimes it's difficult to test it retrospectively. So we actually, when patients come to us and these haven't been done, we would go ahead and do the tests again. So it's important to go ahead and define both stage and cytogenetics at the beginning so that you can classify patients accurately.
Workers get into a situation.
Sorry, Lori,
facilities without a problem.
Sorry, I couldn't hear your question.
I'm sorry. Some of the things that would classify someone as high risk, say 4 years ago, are being very treatable now at some of the bigger facilities such as yours.
Right. Absolutely. So, but still, you have to acknowledge that patients with high risk, by the older definitions, are now being treated with specific targeted agents such as proteasome inhibitors and proteasome inhibitor maintenance and combination treatments, which transform that risk. So, but unless you pick it up, you won't give them that those specific treatments. So it's important to still look at the same things that we looked at all these years, but now that we have treatments, your treatment is more targeted towards those risk factors. That's true.
Thank you, Dr. Hari. I think we need to open up the discussion for the listeners now. Our listeners who would like to ask a question, may please press 1 and we'll bring you online to ask your question. Listeners who want to ask a question, may please press 1. Yes, Tara, you're live on air. Please ask your question.
Yeah, hi. My question is actually from a caregiver perspective. My boyfriend was recently diagnosed. He's 38 years old, was diagnosed. He was in for surgery to have a kidney stone removed, and his levels were really off, and that's when he was diagnosed with myeloma. He did decide to, of course, start treatment. He, against his doctor's wishes, did not want to start with aggressive therapy. He went through Velcade and Dex and did not show any response to that. At this point, I think that he is tired and frustrated, but has decided that he needs to treat this more aggressively. He's had a lot of bone pain lately, went to the doctors yesterday and learned that he has a broken ankle. At that point, they have decided to do initial blood work, of course, and to have an MRI, another MRI scheduled. I'm actually going to the doctor with him on Thursday to see what we're going to do next. This is the first appointment that I'm going to with him, so I'm curious to know what I can expect and also what questions I should be asking at this appointment to help be his advocate during his journey.
Thank you for the question. So it looks like your boyfriend has fairly recently diagnosed myeloma that hasn't responded to a couple of cycles of Velcade. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Again, he's exceptionally young for this disease. At age 38, he's about 3 decades younger than the average person with the disease.
And so I
concur with his doctor that his treatment needs to be aggressive because he stands to lose more from this disease than many other people with this disease. Even with the best treatment, the chances of him making long-term disease control are not so great unless he really tries something extraordinarily strong treatment. So there is no reason to scrimp on the treatment now, because as I suggested earlier, the first remission really is the one that gives you the longest time. Based on providing things don't, providing there's like no blockbuster drugs coming in the future. So and again, the way to get to those blockbuster drugs is to be around when they're in trials and when they're approved. So to get there, we really have to get a good first remission going. So the first thing you need to ask your doctor is, you know, the extent of the disease. How you know, what is his international stage? How where has he got this disease? Why did the doctor recommend aggressive treatment up front? Was it based on his genetic markers of myeloma? What sort of genetic testing did he have for the myeloma cells to see whether they were aggressive or less aggressive? So those are the questions that define the prognosis of the disease from the in terms of cytogenetic markers and staging. Secondly, you could ask the doctor. It would be unfair to get a day-to-day plan of what will happen next, but you should ask him if taking away your boyfriend's wishes, what would the doctor wish the best treatment for his myeloma be? You know, I know the name of your doctor from your email, and he's one of the most respected myeloma doctors in the world, and I would absolutely ask his opinion on how you would expect him, what would be the doctor's own plan for treatment. And then you should try to attempt a reconciliation, if you will, with your boyfriend's concerns. You know, why does your boyfriend not want aggressive treatment? What are his fears? Many a time when a patient decides that he doesn't want treatment X or Y, and the doctor says, I think I should give you this treatment, and if it's not a completely irreconcilable situation, your boyfriend may be worried about certain side effects, certain specific issues that he may want to be addressed, maybe worried about his work, maybe worried about the future in general terms, maybe worried that the treatment might end up causing more harm than good. So you could ask for the doctor to specifically address those concerns. So I think you should have a talk to your boyfriend before you go, and you should write down your questions. And basically, your questions should be regarding prognosis, extent of disease, what he decide what he wants to do for the bones, what he thinks are the best treatment options from this point on. And Velcade failure is not the end of the world, and you should definitely give your boyfriend more hope. You know, single agent Velcade failure, you know, in many ways, there are much better drugs that we, much better combinations that we could have treated him with, especially if he has aggressive myeloma.
Dr. Hari, sorry to interrupt, actually, and we'll be running out of time. We have a couple of more callers online.
Sure.
Thank you so much. We have the next person online. Brenda, you may please ask your question. You have 30 seconds. Brenda,
hi.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Are you? Thank you for your time. Are you seeing any good data on any supplements or certain supplements that show to be helpful with multiple myeloma?
Not in our sort of literature. However, there is this feeling that curcumin, which is a supplement, it is actually something that is used in cooking in many parts of the world, has anti-myeloma activity. Turns out that it is not an easily druggable compound. People are working on it, trying to make it into a drug. But curcumin does work on the NF-kappa B pathway, which is important to survival of plasma cells. And that is one of the most well-validated supplements that is there. But in general, not much information in terms of a supplement that works as well as some of the drugs we have.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hari. Patricia? You're online. You can please ask your question.
Yes, thank you. I'm 64-year-old multiple myeloma patient at the Signe Kimmel Cancer Unit at the Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. And I'm in partial remission. I completed the drug therapy in June. They wanted me to do a stem cell transplant, which I did not want to do, so they recommended a clinical trial, which I am in and chose to do, which is the Imatostat GRN163L, and I'm doing pretty good with that. I just want to know what your prognosis is of that study.
So that's a very tough question. I guess you reserve the toughest question to the end, because it is a study, because we don't really know. So I didn't catch the name of the drugs. What are the drugs that you're receiving now on the study?
It's Imatostat GRN163L. IMETEL.
Oh, okay. Imatostat. Okay. So, I do know about this drug a little bit. Yes. So, that is actually a very reasonable study to attempt. However, it is, as far as I know, a phase 2 study, which
yes.
means that we don't really know if it is better than anything else we have in myeloma right now. So it is an early phase study, and it based on how this drug works, and just based on the laboratory experience with this, it is a very new type of treating a myeloma, in that it blocks a specific RNA pathway in the myeloma cells, and we should expect it to have give you benefit from that, and especially if you didn't want to do the transplant at that time. This is a very reasonable approach to try out. I'm hoping that you have your stem cells collected and stored, right?
No, I did not do that either.
You did not do that either. I would probably, that would be the only thing, you know, at your age, you're young. You should think about having that as having that in the back pocket. Even if you choose not to have it now, you may want to have it done later at some other point. So you may want to discuss with your doctor regarding, you know, having them collected and stored in the freezer so that you can use it if you need it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hari. Gary, I think you can summarize the discussion for us now, please.
Okay, so is that the end of the discussion then?
Yeah, you summarize the discussion then, Gary.
Okay.
Yes.
Dr. Hari, again, just thank you so much for agreeing to do this in the first place, and for your expert advice and counsel during this entire thing. And I think that we all appreciate what you've done. You're obviously quite skilled in the fact that that I think all people should have a skilled professional on their team, and that one thing that you said, the best treatment for relapse just happens to be never to have a relapse. So I think that and your methods by which you'd be able to do that, and so I think that if anything, that came through loud and clear. And I can't tell you how appreciative we are of your efforts and your help with this call. And I apologize if I at all interrupted it. I was just trying to keep the process going through, because I know that we had a number of people at the very end who had important questions that we needed to get to. So thank you for your
Thank you, Gary. Thank you so much. I really appreciated the opportunity to be on this panel. And thank you for keeping me on time. That's actually, I appreciate you doing it.
And you were wonderful.
Thank you so much.
You.
It's been really great to hear such a lot of information on the panel today. Dr. Hari, it was great to have you on our panel. Thank you so much for taking our time for this venture. Many thanks to our panelists, Pat, Matt, Laurie, and Keith, for making this panel discussion flush with the patient perspective. Your top thanks all listeners and participants who have extended their support for the panel today. A special thanks to our co-host, Gary Peterson, who was a driving force behind today's myeloma panel. Thank you, Gary. CureTalk will be conducting monthly myeloma cure panels, and we are encouraging patients and bloggers to come forward and to co-host the show with us. This is a new and unique venture, a new initiative, and hence we need support. Please let us know your feedback. Just drop me a line at priya@trialix.com. Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you. It was lovely having you all here. Thank you.
Thanks, all of you. Bye-bye.